his ancestral home, Foul Manor. Foul Manor, Dublin, Ireland. "Now explain yourself," said Holly, once they had floated Butler safely to bed. She sat on the great stairway's bottom step. Generations of fowls glared down at her from oil portraits on the walls. The LEP captain activated her helmet mic and switched it to loudspeaker. "Foley, record this, would you? I have a feeling we're going to want to hear it again." "This entire incident began at a business meeting this afternoon," began Artemis. "Go on." "I was meeting John Spiro, an American industrialist." Holly heard keys being tapped in her ear. Undoubtedly, Foley was running a background check on this Spiro character. "John Spiro," said the Centaur almost immediately. "A shady character, even by human standards. Madman security agencies have been trying to put this guy away for 30 years. His companies are eco-disasters, and that's on the tip of the iceberg. Industrial espionage, abduction, blackmail, mob connections, you name it, he's gotten away with it." "That's the chap," said Artemis. "So, I set up a rendezvous with Mr. Spiro."
"What were you selling?" interrupted Foley. "A man like Spiro doesn't cross the Atlantic for tea and muffins."
Artemis frowned.
"I wasn't actually selling him anything, but I did offer to suppress some revolutionary technology. For a price, of course."
Foley's voice was cold. "What revolutionary technology?"
Artemis hesitated for a beat.
"Do you remember those helmets Butler took from the retrieval squad?"
Holly groaned. "Oh, no."
"I deactivated the helmet's auto-destruct mechanisms and constructed a cube from the sensors and chips. The C-cube. A mini-computer. It was a simple matter to install a fiber-optic blocker so that you couldn't take control of the cube if you detected it."
"You gave fairy technology to a man like John Spiro?"
"Well, I quite obviously didn't give it to him," snapped Artemis. "He took it."
Holly pointed a finger at the youth.
"Don't bother playing the victim, Artemis. It doesn't suit you. What did you think, that John Spiro was going to walk away from technology that could make him the richest man on the face of the planet?"
"So it was your computer that pinged us," said Foley.
"Yes," admitted Artemis. "Unintentionally. Spiro asked for a surveillance scan, and the cube's fairy circuits picked up LEP satellite beams."
"Can't we block any future probes?" asked the LEP captain.
"Haven's deflectors will be useless against our own technology. Sooner or later, Spiral will find out about the people. And if that happens, I can't see a man like him just allowing us to live in harmony."
Holly glared pointedly at Artemis.
"Remind you of anyone?" "I am nothing like John Spiro," objected the boy. "He's a cold-blooded killer."
"Give yourself a few years," said Holly. "You'll get there."
Foley sighed. Put Artemis Fowl and Holly Short together in a room, and sooner or later, there was bound to be a row.
"Okay, Holly," said the Centaur. "Let's try to act like professionals. Step one is to call off the lockdown. Our next priority is to retrieve the cube before Spiro can unlock its secrets."
"We do have some time," said Artemis. "The cube is encrypted."
"How encrypted?"
"I built in an eternity code into its hard drive."
"An eternity code?" said Foley.
"I'm impressed."
"It wasn't that difficult. I invented an entirely new base language, so Spiro will have no frame of reference."
Holly was feeling a bit left out.
"And how long will it take to crack this eternity code?"
Artemis couldn't resist raising an eyebrow.
"Eternity," he said. "In theory, but with Spiro's resources, quite a bit less."
Holly ignored the tone.
"Okay, then. We're safe.
But no need to go hunting Spiro if all he has is a box of useless circuits."
"Far from useless," countered Artemis.
"The chip design alone will lead his research and development team in interesting directions. But you're right about one thing, Holly. There is no need to go hunting Spiro. Once he realizes that I'm alive, he will come looking for me. After all, I'm the only one who can unlock the full potential of the C-cube."
Holly dropped her head into her hands.
"So, any moment now, a team of hitmen could come blasting in here looking for the key to your eternity code.
It's at times like these that we could do with someone like Butler."
Artemis plucked the war phone from its cradle.
"There's more than one Butler in the family," he said.
Chapter 4. Running in the Family. Sfax, Tunisia, North Africa.
For her 18th birthday, Juliet Butler asked for and received a ribbed judo crash vest, 2 weighted throwing knives, and a World Wrestling Grudge Match video. Items that did not generally feature on the average teenage girl's wish list. Then again, Juliet Butler was not the average teenage girl. Juliet was extraordinary in many ways. For one thing, she could hit a moving target with any weapon you cared to name, and, for another, she could throw most people a lot further than she trusted them. Of course, she didn't learn all this watching wrestling videos. Juliet's training began at age 4. After kindergarten each day, Domovoy Butler would escort his little sister to the Fowl Estate Dojo, where he instructed her in the various forms of martial arts. By the time she was 8, Juliet was a 3rd Dan black belt in 7 disciplines. By 11 years of age, she was beyond belts. Traditionally, all Butler males enrolled in Madame Ko's Personal Protection Academy on their 12th birthday, spending 6 months of every year learning the bodyguard's craft, and the other 6 months guarding a low-risk principal. The female butlers generally went into the service of various wealthy families around the world. However, Juliet decided that she would combine both roles, spending half the year with Angeline Fowl, and the other half honing her martial arts skills in Madame Ko's camp. She was the first butler female to have enrolled in the academy, and only the 5th female ever to make it past the physical exam. The camp was never located in the same country for more than 5 years. Butler had done his training in Switzerland and Israel, but his younger sister received her instruction in the Utsugoshikahara Highlands in Japan. Madame Ko's dormitory was far cry from the luxurious accommodation in Fowl Manor. In Japan, Juliet slept on a straw mat, owned nothing apart from 2 rough cotton robes, and consumed only rice, fish, and protein shakes. The day began at 5:30, when Juliet and the other acolytes ran 4 miles to the nearest stream, catching fish with their bare hands. Having cooked and presented the fish to their sensei, the acolytes strapped empty 20-gallon barrels to their backs and climbed to the snow line. When their barrel was filled with snow, the acolyte would roll it back to the base camp, and then pound the snow with bare feet until it melted and could be used by the sensei to bathe. Then the day's training could begin. Lessons included Kostapa, a martial art developed by Madame Ko herself, specially tailored for bodyguards, whose primary aim was not self-defense, but defense of the principal. Acolytes also studied advanced weaponry, information technology, vehicular maintenance, and hostage negotiation techniques. By her 18th birthday, Juliet could break down and reassemble 90% of the world's production weapons blindfolded, operate any vehicle, do her makeup in under 4 minutes, and, in spite of her stunning Asian and European gene mix, blend into any crowd like a native. Her big brother was very proud. The final step in her training was a field simulation in a foreign environment. If she passed this test, Madame Ko would have Juliet's shoulder marked with a blue diamond tattoo. The tattoo, identical to the one on Butler's shoulder, symbolized not only the graduate's toughness, but also the multifaceted nature of his or her training. In personal protection circles, a bodyguard bearing the blue diamond needed no further reference. Madame Ko had chosen the city of Sfax in Tunisia for Juliet's final assessment. Her mission was to guide the principal through the city's tumultuous market, or Medina. Generally, a bodyguard would advise his principal against venturing into such a densely populated area, but Madame Ko pointed out that principals rarely listened to advice, and it was best to be prepared for every eventuality. And as if Juliet wasn't under enough pressure, Madame Ko herself decided to act as surrogate principal. It was exceptionally hot in North Africa. Juliet squinted through her wraparound sunglasses, concentrating on following the diminutive figure bobbing through the crowd before her. "Hurry!" snapped Madame Ko. "You will lose me!" "In your dreams, madam," replied Juliet, unperturbed. Madame Ko was simply trying to distract her with conversation, and there were already enough distractions in the local environment. Gold hung in shimmering ropes from 12 stalls. Tunisian rugs flapped from wooden frames, the perfect cover for an assassin. Locals pressed uncomfortably close, eager for a look at this attractive female, and the terrain was treacherous. One false step could lead to a twisted ankle, and failure. Juliet processed all this information automatically, factoring it into every move. She placed a firm hand on the chest of a teenager grinning at her, skipped over an oily puddle reflecting rainbow patterns, and followed Madame Co down yet another alley in the Medina's endless maze. Suddenly, there was a man in her face, one of the market traders.
"I have good carpets," he said, in broken French. "You come with me, I show you."
Madame Co kept going. Juliet attempted to follow her, but the man blocked her path.
"No, thank you. I'm so not interested. I live outdoors." "Very funny, mademoiselle. You make good joke. Come and see Ahmed's carpets."
The crowd began to take notice, swirling to face her like the tendrils of a giant organism. Madame Co was moving further away. She was losing the principle.
"I said no, now back off, Mr. Carpetman. Don't make me break a nail."
The Tunisian was unaccustomed to taking orders from a female, and now his friends were watching.
"I give good bargain,"
he persisted, pointing at his stall.
"Best rugs in Sfax."
Juliet dodged to one side, but the crowd moved to cut her off. It was at this point that Ahmed lost any sympathy that Juliet may have had for him. Up to now, he had simply been an innocent local in the wrong place at the wrong time. But now...
"Let's go,"
said the Tunisian, wrapping an arm around the blonde girl's waist. Not an idea that would make it on his top 10 of good ideas.
"Oh, bad move, carpet man."
Faster than the eye could blink, Ahmed was wrapped in the folds of a nearby carpet, and Juliet was gone. Nobody had a clue what had happened until they replayed the incident on the screen of Kamal, the chicken man's camcorder. In slow-mo, the traders saw the Eurasian girl hoist Ahmed by the throat and belt and lob him bodily into a carpet stall. It was a move that one of the gold merchants recognized as a slingshot, a maneuver made popular by the American wrestler Papa Hogg. The traders laughed so much that several of them became dehydrated. It was the funniest thing to happen all year. The clip even won a prize on Tunisia's version of the world's funniest videos. 3 weeks later, Ahmed moved to Egypt. Back to Juliet. The bodyguard in training ran like a sprinter out of the blocks, dodging around stunned merchants and hanging a hard right down an alley. Madame Co couldn't have gone far. She could still complete her assignment. Juliet was furious with herself. This was exactly the kind of stunt her brother had warned her about.
"Watch out for Madame Co," Butler had advised. "You never know what you'll cook up for a field assignment. I heard that she once stampeded a herd of elephants in Calcutta, just to distract an acolyte."
The trouble was that you couldn't be sure. That carpet merchant may have been in Madame Co's employ, or he may have been an innocent civilian who happened to stick his nose in where it didn't belong. The alley narrowed so that the human traffic ran single file. Makeshift clotheslines zigzagged at head height. Gutras and abayas hung limp and steaming in the heat. Juliet ducked below the laundry, dodging around the dawdling shoppers. Startled turkeys hopped as far out of the way as their string leads would allow. And suddenly, she was in a clearing, a dim square surrounded by three-story houses. Men lounged in the upper balconies puffing on fruit-flavoured water pipes. Underfoot was a priceless chipped mosaic, depicting a Roman bath scene. In the centre of the square, lying with her knees hugged to her chest, was Madame Co. She was being assaulted by three men. These were no local traders. All three wore special forces black and attacked with the assurance and accuracy of trained professionals. This was no test. These men were actually trying to kill her sensei. Juliet was unarmed. This was one of the rules. To smuggle arms into the African country would automatically mean life imprisonment. Luckily, it seemed as though her adversaries were also without weapons, though hands and feet would certainly be sufficient for the job they had in mind. Improvisation was the key to survival here. There was no point in attempting a straight assault. If these three had subdued Madame Co, then they would be more than a match for her in regular combat. Time to try something a bit unorthodox. Juliet leapt on the run, snagging a clothesline on her way past. The ring resisted for a second, then popped out of the dried plaster. The cable played out behind her, sagging with its load of rugs and headscarves. Juliet veered left as far as the line's other anchor would allow, and then swung around towards the men. "Hey, boys!" she yelled, not from bravado, but because this would work better head-on. The men looked up just in time to get a faceful of sopping camel hair. The heavy rugs and garments wrapped themselves around their flailing limbs, and the nylon cable caught them below the chins. In under a second, the three were down, and Juliet made certain they stayed down, with pinches to the nerve clusters at the base of their necks.
Madame Co, she cried, searching the laundry for her sensei. The old woman lay shuddering in an olive dress, a plain headscarf covering her face.
Juliet helped the woman to her feet.
Did you see that move, madam? I totally decked those morons. I bet they never saw anything like that before. Improvisation. Butler always says it's the key. You know, I think my eyeshadow distracted them. Glitter green. Never fails.
Juliet stopped talking because there was a knife at her throat. The knife was wielded by Madame Co herself, who was in fact not Madame Co, but some other tiny oriental lady in an olive dress, a decoy.
You are dead, said the lady.
Yes, agreed Madame Co, stepping from the shadows. And if you are dead, then the principal is dead. And you have failed. Juliet bowed low, joining her hands.
That was a sly trick, madam, she said, trying to sound respectful.
Her sensei laughed.
Of course, that is the way of life. What did you expect?
But those assassins, I completely kicked their... I defeated them.
Madame Co dismissed the claim with a wave.
Luck. Fortunately for you, these were not assassins, but three graduates of the academy. What was that nonsense with the wire?
That's a wrestling trick, said Juliet.
It's called the clothesline.
Honorable, said the Japanese lady.
You succeeded because fortune was with you. Fortune is not enough in our business.
It wasn't my fault, protested Juliet.
There was this guy in the market, totally in my face. I had to put him asleep for a while.
Madame Co tapped Juliet between the eyes.
Quiet, girl. Think for once. What should you have done?
Juliet bowed an inch lower.
I should have incapacitated the merchant immediately.
Exactly.
His life means nothing. Insignificant compared to the principal's safety.
I can't just kill innocent people, protested Juliet.
Madame Co sighed.
I know, child. And that is why you are not ready. You have all the skill, but you lack focus and resolve. Perhaps next year.
Juliet's heart plummeted. Her brother had earned the blue diamond at 18 years of age, the youngest graduate in the academy's history. She had been hoping to equal that feat. Now she would have to try again in 12 months. It was pointless to object any further. Madame Co never reversed a decision. A young woman in acolyte's robes emerged from the alley, holding a small briefcase.
Madam, she said, bowing, there is a call for you on the satellite phone.
Madame Co took the offered handset, listening intently for several moments.
A message from Artemis Fowl, she said eventually.
Juliet itched to straighten from her bow, but it would be an unforgivable breach of protocol.
Yes, madam. The message is, Domovoy needs you.
Juliet frowned.
You mean, Butler needs me?
No,
said Madame Co, without a trace of emotion.
I mean, Domovoy needs you. I am just repeating what was told to me.
And suddenly, Juliet could feel the sun pounding on her neck, and she could hear the mosquitoes whining in her ear like dentist's drills, and all she wanted to do was straighten up and run all the way to the airport. Butler would never have revealed his name to Artemis, not unless...
No, she couldn't believe it. She couldn't even allow herself to think it.
Madame Co tapped her chin thoughtfully.
You are not ready. I should not let you leave. You are too emotionally involved to be an effective bodyguard.
Please, madam,
said Juliet.
Her sensei considered it for 2 long minutes.
Very well, she said.
Go.
Juliet was gone before the word finished echoing around the square, and heaven help any carpet merchant who blocked her path. Chapter 5 The Metal Man and the Monkey. The Spiro Needle, Chicago, Illinois, USA. John Spiro took the Concorde from Heathrow to O'Hare International Airport in Chicago. A stretch limo ferried him downtown to the Spiro Needle, a sliver of steel and glass rising 86 stories above the Chicago skyline. Spiro Industries was located on floors 50 through to 85. The 86th floor was Spiro's personal residence, accessible either by private lift or helipad. John Spiro hadn't slept for the entire journey, too excited by the little cube sitting in his briefcase.
The head of his technical staff was equally excited when Spyro informed him what this harmless-looking box was capable of, and immediately scurried off to unravel the Sea Cube's secrets. 6 hours later, he scurried back to the conference room for a meeting.
"It's useless," said the scientist, whose name was Dr. Pearson.
Spyro swirled an olive in his martini glass.
"I don't think so, Pearson," he said. "In fact, I know that little gizmo is anything but useless. I think maybe you're the useless one in this equation."
Spyro was in a terrible mood. Arno Blunt had just called to inform him of Fowl's survival. When Spyro was in dark mood, people had been known to disappear off the face of the Earth, if they were lucky. Pearson could feel the stare of the conference room's third occupant bouncing off his head. This was not a woman you wanted angry with you. Pearson knew that if John Spyro decided to have him thrown out of the window, this particular individual would have no problem signing an affidavit swearing that he had jumped. Pearson chose his words carefully.
"This device... the C-Cube, that's what it's called, I told you, so use the name.
This C-Cube undoubtedly has enormous potential, but it's encrypted."
Spyro threw the olive at his head scientist. It was a humiliating experience for a Nobel Prize winner.
"So break the encryption. What do I pay you guys for?"
Pearson could feel his heart rate speeding up.
"It's not that simple. This code, it's unbreakable."
"Let me get this straight," said Spyro, leaning back in his oxblood leather chair. "I'm putting $200 million a year into your department, and you can't break one lousy code set up by a kid."
Pearson was trying not to think about the sound his body would make hitting the pavement. His next sentence would save him or damn him.
"The cube is voice activated and coded to Artemis Fowl's voice patterns. Nobody can break the code. It's not possible."
Spyro did not respond. It was a signal to continue. "I've heard of something like this. We scientists theorize about it. An eternity code, it's called. The code has millions of possible permutations, and not only that, but it's based on an unknown language. It seems as though this boy has created a language that is spoken only by him. We don't even know how it corresponds to English. A code like this is not even supposed to exist. If Fowl is dead, then I'm sorry to say, Mr. Spyro, but the C-Cube died with him." John Spyro stuck a cigar into the corner of his mouth. He did not light it. His doctors had forbidden it, politely.
"And if Fowl were alive..."
Pearson knew a lifeline when it was being thrown to him.
"If Fowl were alive, he would be a lot easier to break than an eternity code."
"Okay, Doc," said Spyro. "You're dismissed. You don't want to hear what's coming next."
Pearson gathered his notes and hurried for the door. He tried not to look at the face of the woman at the table. If he didn't hear what came next, he could kid himself that his conscience was clear. And if he didn't actually see the woman at the conference table, then he couldn't pick her out at a lineup.
"It looks like we have a problem," said Spyro to the woman in the dark suit.
The woman nodded. Everything she wore was black. Black power suit, black blouse, black stilettos, even the Rado watch on her wrist was jet black.
"Yeah, but it's my kind of problem."
Carla Frazetti was goddaughter to Spats Antonelli, who ran the downtown section of the Berti crime family. Carla operated as liaison between John Spyro and Antonelli, possibly the two most powerful men in Chicago. Spyro had learned early in his career that businesses allied to the mob tended to flourish. Carla checked her manicured nails.
"It seems to me that you only have one option. You nab the Fowl kid and squeeze him for this code."
Spyro sucked on his unlit cigar, thinking about it.
"It's not that straightforward. The kid runs a tight operation. Fowl Manor is like a fortress."
Carla smiled.
"This is a 13-year-old kid we're talking about, right?"
"He'll be 14 in 6 months," said Spyro defensively.
"Anyway, there are complications."
"Such as?"
"Arno is injured. Somehow, Fowl blew his teeth out."
"Ouch,"
said Carla, wincing.
"He can't even stand in a breeze, never mind head up an operation."
"That's a shame."
"In fact, the kid incapacitated all my best people. They're on a dental plan, too. It's going to cost me a fortune. No, I need some outside help on this one.
You want to contract the job to us?
Exactly. But it's got to be the right people. Ireland is an old world kind of place. Wise guys are going to stick out a mile. I need guys who blend in and can persuade a kid to accompany them back here. Easy money. Carlo winked.
I read you, Mr. Spiro.
So, you got guys like that? Guys who can take care of business without drawing attention to themselves?
The way I see it, you need a metal man and a monkey.
Spiro nodded, familiar with mob slang. Metal man carried the gun, and a monkey got into hard-to-reach places.
We have two such men on our books. I can guarantee they won't attract the wrong kind of attention in Ireland, but it won't be cheap.
Are they good? Asked Spiro.
Carla smiled. One of her incisors was inset with a tiny ruby.
Oh, they're good, she replied. These guys are the best.
The Metal Man. 2 p.m., the Ink Blot Tattoo Parlor, downtown Chicago. Loafers McGuire was having a tattoo done, a skull's head in the shape of the Ace of Spades. It was his own design, and he was very proud of it. So proud, in fact, that he'd wanted the tattoo on his neck. Inky Burton, the tattooist, managed to change Loafer's mind, arguing that neck tattoos were better than a name tag when the cops wanted to ID a suspect. Loafers relented.
Okay, he said. Put it on my forearm.
Loafers had a tattoo done after every job. There wasn't much skin left on his body that still retained its original color. That was how good Loafers McGuire was at his job. Loafers' real name was Aloysius, and he hailed from the Irish town of Kilkenny. He'd come up with the name Loafers himself, because he thought it sounded more mob-like than Aloysius. All his life, Loafers had wanted to be a mobster, just like in the movies. When his efforts to start a Celtic mafia had failed, Loafers came to Chicago. The Chicago mob welcomed him with open arms. Actually, one of their enforcers grabbed him in a bear hug. Loafers sent the man and six of his buddies to the Mother of Mercy Hospital. Not bad for a guy 5 feet tall. 8 hours after stepping off the plane, Loafers was on the payroll. And here he was, 2 years and several jobs later, already the Frazetti's top metal man. His specialities were robbery and debt collection. Not the usual line of work for five-footers, but then Loafers was not the usual five-footer. Loafers leaned back in the tattooist's adjustable chair.
You like the shoes, Inky?
Inky blinked sweat from his eyes. You had to be careful with Loafers. Even the most innocent question could be a trap. One wrong answer and you could find yourself making your excuses to St. Peter.
Yeah, I like 'em. What are they called?
Loafers, snapped the tiny gangster. Loafers, idiot! They're my trademark!
Oh yeah, Loafers, I forgot. Cool, having a trademark.
Loafers checked the progress on his arm.
You ready with that needle yet?
Just ready, replied Inky. I'm finished painting on the guidelines. I just gotta put in a fresh needle.
It's not gonna hurt, is it?
Of course it is, you moron, thought Inky. I'm sticking a needle in your arm. But out loud, he said, not too much. I gave your arm a swab of anesthetic.
It better not hurt,
warned Loafers,
or you'll be hurting shortly afterwards.
Nobody threatened Inky, except Loafers McGuire. Inky did all the mob's tattoo work. He was the best in the state. Carla Frazetti pushed through the door. Her black-suited elegance seemed out of place in the dingy establishment.
Hello, boys,
she said.
Hello, Miss Carla, said Inky, blushing deeply.
You didn't get too many ladies in the ink blot. Loafers jumped to his feet. Even he respected the boss's goddaughter.
Miss Frazetti, you could have beat me. No need for you to come down to this dump.
No time for that. This is urgent. You leave straight away.
I'm leaving. Where am I going?
Ireland. Your Uncle Pat is sick.
Loafers frowned.
Uncle Pat? I don't have an Uncle Pat.
Carla tapped the toe of one stiletto.
He's sick, Loafers. Real sick, if you catch my drift.
Loafers finally caught on.
Oh, I get it. So, I gotta pay him a visit.
That's it. That's exactly how sick he is.
Loafers used a rag to clean the ink off his arm.
Okay, I'm ready. Are we going straight to the airport?
Carla linked the tiny gangster.
Soon, Loafers, but first we need to pick up your brother.
I don't have a brother,
protested Loafers.
Of course you do. The one with the keys to Uncle Pat's house? He's a regular little monkey.
Oh,
said Loafers.
That brother.
Loafers and Carla took the limo out to the east side. Loafers were still in awe of the sheer size of American buildings. In Kilkenny, there was nothing over 5 stories, and Loafers himself had lived all his life in a suburban bungalow. Not that he would ever admit that to his mob friends. For their benefit, he had reinvented himself as an orphan, who spent his youth in and out of various remand homes.
"Who's the monkey?" he asked.
Carla Frazetti was fixing her jet-black hair in a compact mirror. It was short and slicked back.
"A new guy, Mo Digence. He's Irish, like you. It makes things very convenient. No visas, no papers, no elaborate cover story. Just 2 short guys home for the holidays."
Loafers bristled.
"What do you mean, 2 short guys?
Carla snapped the compact shut. "Who are you talking to, Maguire? Because you couldn't be talking to me. Not in that tone." Loafers paled, his life flashing before him.
"I'm sorry, Miss Frazetti. It's just a short thing. I've been listening to it my whole life."
"What do you want people to call you? Lofty? You're short, Loafers. Get over it. That's what gives you your edge. My godfather said there's nothing more dangerous than a short guy with something to prove. That's why you've got a job."
"I suppose."
Carla patted him on the shoulder. "Cheer up, Loafers. Compared to this guy, you're a regular giant." Loafers perked up considerably.
"Really? Just how short is Mo Digence?"
"He's short," said Carla. "I don't know the exact centimeters, but any shorter, I'd be changing his diaper and stuffing him in a stroller." Loafers grinned. He was going to enjoy this job. The Monkey. Mo Digence had seen better days. Less than 4 months ago, he had been living it up in a Los Angeles penthouse, with over $1 million in the bank. But now his funds had been frozen by the Criminal Assets Bureau, and he was working for the Chicago mob on a commission basis. Spatz Antonelli was not known for the generosity of his commissions. Of course, Mo could always leave Chicago and go back to L.A., but there was a police task force there, with his name on it, just waiting for him to return to the scene of the crime. In fact, there was no safe haven for Mo, above ground or below it, because Mo Digence was actually Munch Diggums, kleptomaniac dwarf and fugitive from the L.E.P. Mulch was a tunnel dwarf who decided that a life in the mines was not for him and put his mining talents to another use, namely, relieving mud people of their valuables and selling them on the fairy black market. Of course, entering another's dwellings without permission meant forfeiting your magic, but Mulch didn't care. Dwarves didn't have much power anyway, and casting spells had always made him nauseous. Dwarves have several physical features that make them ideal burglars. They can dislocate their jaws, ingesting several kilos of dirt a second. This dirt is stripped of any beneficial minerals, then ejected at the other end. They have also developed the ability to drink through their pores, an attribute that can be very handy during cave-ins. It also transforms the pores into living suction cups, a convenient tool in any burglar's arsenal. Finally, dwarf hair is actually a network of living antennae, similar to feline whiskers, which can do everything from trap beetles to bounce sonar waves off a tunnel wall. Mulch had been a rising star in the fairy underworld until Commander Julius Root got hold of his file. Since then, he had spent over 300 years in and out of prison. He was actually on the run for stealing several gold bars from the Holly Short Ransom Fund. There was no safe haven below ground anymore, even among his own kind. So Mulch was forced to pass himself off as human and take whatever work he could get from the Chicago mob. There were hazards associated with impersonating a human. Of course, his size drew attention from everyone who happened to glance downwards. But Mulch quickly discovered that mud people could find a reason to distrust almost anyone. Height, weight, skin colour, religion. It was almost safer to be different in some way. The sun was a bigger problem. Dwarves are extremely photosensitive, with a burn time of less than 3 minutes. Luckily, Mulch's job generally involved night work. But when he was forced to venture abroad in daylight hours, the dwarf made certain that every inch of his exposed skin was covered with long-lasting sunblock. Mulch had rented a basement apartment in an early 20th century brownstone. It was a bit of a fixer-upper, but this suited the dwarf just fine. He stripped out the floorboards in the bedroom, dumping 2 tons of topsoil and fertilizer onto the rotten foundations. Mold and damp already clung to the walls, so no need to remodel anything there. In a matter of hours, insect life was thriving in the room. Mulch would lie back in his pit and snag cockroaches with his beard hair. Home, sweet home. Not only was the apartment beginning to resemble a tunnel cave, but if the LEP came a-calling, he could be 50 meters below ground in the blink of an eye. In the coming days, Mulch would come to regret not taking that route as soon as he heard the knock at the door.
There was a knock at the door.
Mulch crawled out of his tunnel bed and checked the video buzzer. Carla Frazetti was checking her hair in the brass knocker. The boss's goddaughter, in person.
This must be a big job. Perhaps the commission will be enough to set him up in another state.
He'd been in Chicago for nearly 3 months now, and it was only a matter of time before the LEP picked up his trail. He would never leave the US, though. If you had to live above ground, it might as well be somewhere with cable TV and a lot of rich people to steal from. Mulch pressed the intercom panel.
Just a minute, Miss Rossetti, I'm getting dressed.
Hurry up, Mo, snapped Carla, her voice crackly through the cheap speakers. I'm getting old here. Mulch threw on a robe he'd fashioned from old potato sacks. He found the texture of the cloth reminiscent of Haven Penitentiary pajamas to be weirdly comforting. He gave his beard a quick comb to dislodge any straggling beetles, and answered the door. Carla Frazetti swept past him into the lounge, settling into the room's only armchair. There was another person on the doorstep, hidden beneath the camera's field. Mulch made a mental note. Redirect the CCTV lens. A fairy could sneak right in under it, even if he or she wasn't shielded. The man gave Mulch a dangerous squint. Typical mob behavior. Just because these people were murdering gangsters didn't mean they had to be rude.
Don't you have another chair?
Asked the small human, following Miss Frazetti into the lounge. Mulch closed the door.
I don't get many visitors. Actually, you're the first. Usually Bruno beeps me and I come into the chop shop.
Bruno the Cheese was the mob's local supervisor. He ran his business from a local hot car warehouse. Legend had it that he hadn't been out from behind his desk during the work hours in 15 years.
Quite a look you got going here, said Loafers sarcastically. Moulding woodlice. I like it.
Mulch ran a fond finger along a green strip of damp.
That mould was just sitting behind the wallpaper when I moved in. Amazing what people cover up.
Carla Frazetti took a bottle of White Petals perfume from her bag, spraying the air around her person.
Okay, enough conversation. I have a special job for you, Mo.
Mulch forced himself to stay calm. This was his big chance. Maybe he could find a nice damp hellhole and settle down for a while.
Is this the kind of job where there's a big payoff, if you do it right?
No, replied Carla. This is the kind of job where there's a painful payoff if you do it wrong.
Mulch sighed. Didn't anyone talk nicely anymore?
So why me?
Carla Frazetti smiled, her ruby winking in the gloom.
I'm going to answer that question, Mo, even though I'm not used to explaining myself to the hired help, especially not a monkey like yourself.
Mulch swallowed. Sometimes he forgot how ruthless these people were. Never for long.
You've been chosen for this assignment, Mo, because of the outstanding job you did with that Van Gogh.
Mulch smiled modestly. The museum alarm had been child's play. There hadn't even been any dogs.
But also, you have an Irish passport.
A gnome fugitive hiding out in NYC had run him up some Irish papers on a stolen LEP copier. The Irish had always been Mulch's favourite humans, so he had decided to be one. He should have known it would lead to trouble.
This particular job is in Ireland, which might be a problem generally, but for you two, it'll be like a paid holiday.
Mulch nodded at Loafers.
Who's the mutt?
Loafers' squint narrowed. Mulch knew that if Miss Frazetti gave the word, the man would kill him on the spot.
The mutt is Loafers Maguire, your partner. He's a metal man. It's a two-tier job. You open the doors, Loafers escorts the mark back here.
Escorting the mark? Mulch knew what that term meant, and he didn't want any part of it. Robbery was one thing, but kidnapping was another. Mulch knew that he couldn't actually turn down this assignment. What he could do was ditch the metal man at the first opportunity and head to one of the southern states. Apparently Florida had some lovely swamps.
So, who's the mark?
Said Mulch, pretending that it mattered.
That's need-to-know information, said Loafers.
And let me guess, I don't need to know.
Carla Frazetti pulled a photograph from her coat pocket.
The less you know, the less you have to feel guilty about. This is all you need, the house. This photograph is all we have for the moment. You can case the joint when you get there.
Mulch took the photo. What he saw on the paper hit him like a gas attack. It was foul manner. Therefore, Artemis was the target. This little psychopath was being sent to kidnap Artemis. Frazetti sensed his discomfort.
Something wrong, Mo?
Don't let it show on your face, thought Mulch.
Don't let them see.
No, it's, that's quite a setup. I can see alarm boxes and outdoor spots. It's not going to be easy.
If it was easy, I'd do it myself, said Carla.
Loafers took a step forward, looking down at Mulch.
What's the matter, little man? Too tough for you?
Mulch was forced to think on his feet.
If Carla Frazetti thought he wasn't up to the job, then they would send somebody else. Somebody with no qualms about leading the mob to Artemis's door.
Mulch was surprised to realize that he couldn't let that happen.
The Irish boy had saved his life during the Goblin Rebellion, and that was the closest thing he had to a friend.
Which was pretty pathetic when he thought about it. He had to take the job, if only to make sure that it didn't go according to plan.
Hey, don't worry about me. A building hasn't been built that Mo Digents can't crack. I just hope Loafers is man enough for the job.
Loafers grabbed the dwarf by the lapels.
What's that supposed to mean, Digents?
Mulch generally avoided insulting people who were likely to kill him, but it might be useful to establish Loafers as a hothead now, especially if he was going to blame him for things going wrong later.
It's one thing being a midget monkey, but a midget metal man. How good can you be at close quarters?
Loafers dropped the dwarf and ripped open his shirt to reveal a chest rippling with tapestry of tattoos.
That's how good I am, Digents. Count the tattoos. Count 'em.
Mulch shot Miss Frazetti a loaded look. The look said, You're going to trust this guy?
That's enough, said Carla. The testosterone in here is starting to stink worse than the walls. This is a very important job. If you two can't handle it, I'll bring in another team.
Loafers buttoned his shirt.
Okay, Miss Frazetti. We can handle it. This job is as good as done.
Carla stood, brushing a couple of centipedes from the hem of her jacket. The insects didn't bother her unduly. She'd seen a lot worse in her 25 years.
Glad to hear it. Mo, put some clothes on and grab your monkey kit. We'll wait in the limo.
Loafers poked Mulch in the chest.
5 minutes, then we're coming in to get you.
Mulch watched them go. This was his last chance to duck out. He could chew through the bedroom foundations and be on a southbound train before Carla Frazetti knew he was gone. Mulch thought about it seriously. This kind of thing was totally against his nature. It wasn't that he was a bad fairy, it was simply that he wasn't accustomed to helping other people. Not unless there was something in it for him. Deciding to help Artemis Fowl was a completely selfless act. Mulch shuddered. A conscience was the last thing he needed right now. Next thing he knew, he'd be selling cookies for the Girl Guides. Chapter 6 Assault on Fowl Manor. Excerpt from Artemis Fowl's diary, Disc 2, encrypted.
My father had finally regained consciousness. I was, of course, relieved, but his last words to me that day were chasing themselves around my mind. Gold isn't all important, Artie, he had said. Neither is power. We have everything we need right here, the three of us. Was it possible that the magic had transformed my father? I had to know. I needed to speak to him alone. So, at 3 a.m. the following morning, I had Butler bring me back to Helsinki's University Hospital in the rented Mercedes. Father was still awake, reading War and Peace by lamplight. Not many laughs, he commented. More jokes. I tried to smile, but my face just wasn't in the mood. Father closed the book. I've been expecting you, Artie. We need a talk. There are a few things we have to straighten out. I stood stiffly at the foot of the bed. Yes, Father, I agree. Father's smile was tinged with sadness. So formal. I remember being the same with my own father. I sometimes think that he didn't know me at all. And I worry that the same thing will happen to us. So I want us to talk, son. Not about bank accounts, not stocks and shares, not corporate takeovers. I don't want to talk business. I want to talk about you. I'd been afraid of this.
Me? You are the priority here, Father.
Perhaps, but I cannot be happy until your mother's mind is put at rest.
At rest? I asked, as though I didn't know where this was going.
Don't play the innocent, Artemis. I've called a few of my law enforcement contacts around Europe. Apparently, you have been active in my absence.
Very active.
I shrugged, unsure whether I was being scolded or praised.
Not so long ago I would have been very impressed by your antics, such audacity, and still a minor. But now, speaking as a father, things have to change, Artie. You must reclaim your childhood. It is my wish, and your mother's, that you return to school after the holidays and leave the family's business to me. But, Father, trust me, Artie. I've been in business a lot longer than you. I have promised your mother that the fowls are on the straight and narrow from now on. All of the fowls. I have another chance, and I will not waste it on greed. We are a family now. A proper one. From now on, the fowl name will be associated with honour and honesty. Agreed. Agreed, I said, clasping his hand. But what of my meeting with Chicago's John Sparrow? I decided to proceed as planned. One last adventure. Then the fowls could be a proper family. After all, Butler would accompany me. What could go wrong?
Fowl Manor.
Butler opened his eyes. He was home. Artemis was asleep on the armchair beside the bed. The boy looked 100 years old. It wasn't surprising after all he'd been through. That life was over now. All of it.
Anybody home? Said the manservant.
Artemis was instantly alert. Butler, you come back to us. Butler struggled onto his elbows. It was quite an effort.
It's a surprise to me. I never expected to see you or anyone ever again.
Artemis poured a glass of water from the bedside jug. Here, old friend, just rest. Butler drank slowly. He was tired, but it was more than that. He had felt battle fatigue before, but this went deeper.
Artemis, what has happened? I shouldn't be alive at all. And if I accept that I am alive, then I should be experiencing massive amounts of pain right about now.
Artemis crossed to the window, looking out over the estate. Blunt shot you. It was a fatal wound, and Holly wasn't around to help. So I froze you until she arrived. Butler shook his head.
Cryogenics? Only Artemis Fowl. You used the fresh freezers, I suppose.
Artemis nodded.
I trust I am not part freshwater trout now, eh?
When Artemis turned to face his friend, he was not smiling. There were complications.
Complications?
Artemis took a breath. It was a difficult healing, no way to predict the outcome. Foley warned that it may be too much for your system, but I insisted we press on. Butler sat up.
Artemis, that's all right. I'm alive. Anything is better than the alternative.
Artemis was not reassured. He took a pearl-handled mirror from the locker.
Prepare yourself and take a look.
Butler took a deep breath and looked. He stretched his jaw and pinched the bags beneath his eyes.
Just how long was I out? He asked.
Transatlantic Boeing, 747. Mulch had decided that the best way to undermine the mission was to antagonize loafers until he went crazy. Driving people crazy was a talent of his, and one that he didn't get to exercise often enough. The two diminutive individuals were seated side by side in a 747, watching the clouds shoot past below. First class. One of the perks of working for the Antonellis. Mulch sipped delicately from a champagne flute.
So, slabbers. That's loafers. Oh yes, loafers. What's the story behind all the tattoos?
Loafers rolled up his sleeve, revealing a turquoise snake with drops of blood for eyes. Another of his own designs.
I get one done after every job.
Oh, said Mulch.
So if you paint a catch in, you get a tattoo.
Not that kind of a job, stupid.
What kind of a job, then?
Loafers ground his teeth.
I have to spell it out for you.
Mulch pinched some peanuts from a passing tray.
No point. I never got no schooling. Plain English will be fine.
You can't be this stupid. Spats Antonelli doesn't hire morons.
Mulch gave a smarmy wink.
You sure about that?
Loafers patted his shirt, hoping to find a weapon of some kind.
You wait until this is over, smart Alec. Me and you will settle our differences.
You keep telling yourself that, Boots.
Loafers!
Whatever.
Mulch hid behind the airline magazine. This was too easy. The mobster was half-crazed already. A few more hours in Mulch's company should be enough to have Loafers Maguire foaming at the mouth. Dublin Airport, Ireland. Mulch and Loafers passed through Irish customs without incident.
After all, they were simply citizens returning home for the holidays. It wasn't as if they were a mob team up to no good. How could they be? Who ever heard of little people being involved in organized crime? Nobody. But maybe that was because they were very good at it. Passport control provided Mulch with another opportunity to infuriate his partner. The officer was doing his best not to notice Mulch's height, or lack of it.
So, Mr. Digent's home to visit the family?
Mulch nodded.
That's right. My mother's folks are from Killarney.
Oh, really?
O'Reilly, actually, but what's a vowel between friends?
Very good. You should be on the stage.
It's funny you should mention that.
The passport officer groaned. 10 more minutes and his shift would have been over.
I was being sarcastic, actually, he muttered.
Because my friend, Mr. Maguire, and I are also doing a stint in the Christmas pantomime. It's Snow White, I'm Doc, and he's Dopey.
The passport officer forced a smile.
Very good. Next.
Mulch spoke for the entire queue to hear.
Of course, Mr. Maguire there was born to play Dopey, if you catch my drift.
Loafers lost it right there in the terminal.
You little freak! He screamed. I'll kill you! You'll be my next tattoo! You'll be my next tattoo!
Mulch tutted as loafers disappeared beneath half a dozen security guards.
Actors, he said. Highly strung.
They released loafers 3 hours later after a full search and several phone calls to the parish priest in his hometown. Mulch was waiting in the pre-ordered rental car, a specially modified model with elevated accelerator and brake pedals.
Your temper is seriously jeopardizing this operation, commented the dwarf, straight-faced. I'll have to phone Miss Frizzetti if you can't control yourself.
Shrive,
said the metal man hoarsely.
Let's get this over with.
Okay, then, but you're on your very last chance. One more episode like that, and I'm going to have to crush your head between my teeth.
Loafers noticed his partner's teeth for the first time. They were tombstone-shaped blocks of enamel, and there seemed to be an awful lot of them for just one mouth. Was it possible that Digent could actually do what he threatened?
No, Loafers decided. He was just a bit spooked after the customs interrogation. Still, there was something about the dwarf's smile, a glint that spoke of hidden and frightening talents, talents that the metal man would prefer to stay hidden.
Mulch took care of the driving while Loafers made a couple of calls on his mobile phone. It was a simple matter for him to contact a few old associates and arrange for a weapon, a silencer, and 2 headsets to be left in a duffel bag behind the motorway exit sign for Foul Manor. Loafers' associates even took credit cards, so there was no need for the usual macho trade-off that generally accompanied black market transactions. Loafers checked the weapon's action and sights in the car. He felt in control again.
So, Moe, said Loafers,
chuckling as if that simple rhyme was the funniest joke he'd ever made. And sadly, it was.
Have you put together a plan yet?
Mulch didn't take his eyes from the road.
Nope. I thought you were the head honcho here. Plans of your department, I just break and enter.
That's right. I am the head honcho, and believe me, Master Fowl is going to realize that, too, when I'm finished talking to him.
Master Fowl, said Mulch innocently. We're here for some kid.
Not just some kid, revealed Loafers, against orders. Artemis Fowl, heir to the Fowl Criminal Empire. He has something in his head that Miss Frizzetti wants. So, we're supposed to impress upon the little brat how important it is that he come with us and spill the beans.
Mulch's grip tightened on the wheel. He should have made his move before now. But the trick was not to incapacitate Loafers. It was convincing Carla Frizzetti not to send another team. Artemis would know what to do. He had to get to the boy before Loafers did. A mobile phone and a visit to the bathroom were all he needed. A pity he had never bothered purchasing a phone, but there had never been anybody to call before. Besides, you could never be too careful with Foley. That centaur could triangulate a chirping cricket.
We better stop for supplies, said Loafers. It could take days to check this place out.
No need. I know the layout. I burgled this place before in my youth. Piece of cake.
And you didn't mention this before because...
Mulch made a rude gesture at a lorry driver hogging both lanes.
Ah, you know the way it is. I work on commission. The commission is calculated on a hardship basis. The second I say I turn this place over before, 10 grand is cut off my fee.
Loafers didn't argue. It was true. You always over-exaggerated the difficulty of the job. Anything to squeeze a few more bucks out of your employer.
So, you can get us in there.
I can get me in there. Then I come back out for you.
Loafers was suspicious.
Why didn't I just come with you?
It'd be a lot easier than hanging around in broad daylight.
Firstly, I'm not going in until after dark. And secondly,
sure you can come with me, if you don't mind crawling through the septic tank and up 9 meters of effluent pipe.
Loafers had to open a window at the thought of it.
Okay, you come and get me. But we stay in contact over the headsets. Anything goes wrong, and you let me know.
Yes, sir, boss,
said Mulch, screwing the earpiece into his hairy ear and clipping the mic to his jacket.
Wouldn't want you to miss your appointment intimidating a kid.
The sarcasm made a slight whistling noise as it flew over Loafer's head.
That's right, said the Kilkenny man. I am the boss, and you don't want to make me late for my appointment.
Mulch had to concentrate to stop his beard hair curling. Dwarf hair is very mood sensitive, especially to hostility, and it was flowing out of this man's every pore. Mulch's bristles had never been wrong yet. This little partnership was not going to end well. Mulch parked in the shadow of the Fowl Estate's boundary wall.
You certain this is the place? Asked Loafers.
Mulch pointed a stubby finger at the ornate iron gate.
You see where it says Fowl Manor?
Yes.
I'd say this is probably the place.
Even Loafers couldn't miss a direct jibe like that.
You better get me in there, Digence, or...
Mulch showed him his teeth.
Or what?
Or... Miss Frazetti will be extremely annoyed,
completed Loafers, lamely, well aware that he was losing the hard man banter battle. Loafers resolved to teach Mo Digence a lesson, as soon as possible.
We wouldn't want to annoy Miss Frazetti, said Mulch.
He climbed down from the elevated seat and reclaimed his gear bag from the trunk. There were certain unorthodox burglary tools in the bag, supplied by his fairy fence in New York. Hopefully none of them would be needed, not the way he intended gaining entrance to the manor. Mulch rapped on the passenger window. Loafers buzzed it open.
What?
Remember, you stay here until I come and get you.
That sounds like an order, Digence. Are you giving me orders now?
Me?
Said Mulch, revealing the full expanse of his teeth.
Giving orders? Wouldn't dream of it.
Loafers buzzed the window back up.
You better not be,
he said, as soon as there was a layer of toughened glass between him and those teeth. Inside Fowl Manor, Butler had just finished clipping and shaving. He was beginning to look like his old self again. His older self.
Kevlar, you say?
He repeated, examining the darkened tissue on his chest. Artemis nodded. Apparently some fibres were trapped in the wound. The magic replicated them. According to Foley, the new tissue will restrict your breathing, but it isn't dense enough to be bulletproof, except for a small caliber bullet. Butler buttoned his shirt.
Everything is different, Artemis. I can't guard you anymore.
I won't need guarding. Holly was right. My grand schemes generally lead to people getting hurt. As soon as we have dealt with Spyro, I intend to concentrate on my education.
As soon as we have dealt with Spyro? You make it sound like a foregone conclusion. John Spyro was a dangerous man, Artemis. I thought you would have learned that.
I have, old friend. Believe me, I won't underestimate him again. I've already begun to formulate a plan. We should be able to retrieve the C-cube and neutralize Mr. Spyro, providing Holly agrees to help.
Where is Holly? I need to thank her. Again.
Artemis glanced out of the window. She's gone to complete the ritual. You can guess where. Butler nodded. They had first encountered Holly at a sacred fairy site in the southeast while she was conducting the power-restoring ritual. Although encountered was not the term Holly used, abducted was closer to the truth. She should be back within the hour. I suggest you rest until then. Butler shook his head.
I can rest later. Right now, I have to check the grinds. It's unlikely that Spyro could put a team together so quickly, but you never know.
The bodyguard crossed to a wall panel that linked his room to the security system control booth. Artemis could see that each step was an effort. With Butler's new chest tissue, just climbing the stairs would seem like a marathon. Butler split-screened his monitor, so he could view all the CCTVs simultaneously. One of the screens interested him more than the others, so he punched it up on the monitor.
Well, well, he chuckled. Look who's dropped in to say hello.
Artemis crossed to the security panel. There was a very small individual making rude gestures at the kitchen door camera. Mulch Diggums, said Artemis. Just the dwarf I wanted to see. Butler transferred Mulch's image to the main screen.
Perhaps. But why does he want to see you?
Melodramatic as always, the dwarf insisted on a sandwich before explaining the situation. Unfortunately for Mulch, it was Artemis who volunteered to prepare it for him. He emerged from the pantry with what resembled nothing more than an explosion on a plate.
It's more difficult.